TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, An Indigenous People's History of the United States. Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz grew up in rural Oklahoma, the daughter of a tenant farmer and part Indian mother. She holds a PhD in history and is an activist in the international indigenous movement for more than four decades. Her 1977 book, The Great Sioux Nation, was the fundamental document at the first International Conference on Indigenous Peoples of the Americas. That conference was held at the United Nations headquarters in Geneva. The late, great Howard Zinn, author of the now world-famous book, A People's History of the United States, was her friend, and he played a role in convincing Beacon Press to commission and publish An Indigenous People's History of the United States. Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz had an ongoing friendly controversy with Howard Zinn over an event that is often described as the final victory by the U.S. Army over the last armed Indian resistance, the massacre at Wounded Knee in 1890. Here's Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz.
He was a friend of mine, and all these years I criticized him for terminating the indigenous narrative, the Native American narrative, at the end of the frontier, so-called, basically 1890, with a massacre at Wounded Knee and the end of armed resistance by Native nations. And then suddenly, Native Americans appear again in 1969 with the seizure of Alcatraz. I would tease Howard and say, what happened? Were they hibernating all those years, you know, 70, 80 years? And he said, well, you need to write that book. You know? So before he passed away, he suggested to Beacon Press that they do different versions of people's histories that his book couldn't cover, to go in more depth, like African-American or Black people's history of the United States, women's history of the United States. And he said, but especially an indigenous people's history of the United States, and you should ask Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz to do it. I now think this was a curse because of my criticisms. Not really, but It was a very hard book to write because it was to be a concise book, a very readable for the general educated reader, not an academic book, but a book that could be used in university courses or high school courses, sort of like Howard's book. So I'm very proud that this book is a part of Beacon's Revisioning American History series. So I thought I would read from one of the chapters. In the first chapter, I write about the 100,000 years before the Europeans came to the Western Hemisphere and what was going on here and what was going on in Europe that led to the invasion of the Americas by Spain, Portugal, and the Dutch and the French and the British, and colonization of the whole Western Hemisphere in Africa. That's called the culture of conquest. So this third chapter I'm going to read to think about the initial colonies. I call this chapter The Cult of the Covenant. So with the onset of colonialism in North America, control of the land was wrenched away from the indigenous peoples, and the forests grew dense, so that later European settlers were unaware of the former cultivation and sculpting and manicuring of the landscape. Abandoned fields of corn turned to weeds and bushes. Settlers chopped down trees in New England until the landscape was nearly bare. One geographer notes, paradoxical as it may seem, there was undoubtedly much more forest primeval in 1850 than in 1650. Anglo-Americans who did observe native habitat management in action misunderstood what they saw. Captain John Palliser, traveling through the prairies in the 1850s, complained about the Indians' quote, disastrous habit of setting the prairie on fire for the most trivial and worse than useless reasons, unquote. In the founding myth of the United States, the colonists acquired a vast expanse of land from a scattering of benighted peoples who were hardly using it, an unforgivable offense to the Puritan work ethic. The historical record is clear, however, that European colonists shoved aside a large network of small and large nations whose governments, commerce, arts and sciences, agriculture, technologies, theologies, philosophies and institutions were intricately developed. Nations that maintained sophisticated relations with one another and with the environments that supported them. By the early 17th century, when British colonists from Europe began to settle in North America, a large indigenous population had long before created, quote, a humanized landscape almost everywhere, as William Denovan puts it. Native peoples had created town sites, farms, monumental earthworks, and networks of roads, and they had devised a wide variety of governments, some as complex as any in the world. They had developed sophisticated philosophies of government, traditions of diplomacy, and policies of international relations. They conducted trade along roads that crisscrossed the land masses and waterways of the American continents. Before the arrival of Europeans, North America was indeed a continent of villages, but also a continent of nations and federations of nations. Many have noted that had North America been a wilderness, undeveloped, without roads, and uncultivated, it might still be so, for the European colonists could not have survived. They appropriated what had already been created by indigenous civilizations. They stole already cultivated farmland and the corn, vegetables, tobacco, and other crops domesticated over centuries, took control of the deer parks that had been cleared and maintained by indigenous communities, used existing roads and water routes in order to move armies to conquer, and relied on captured indigenous people to identify the locations of water, oyster beds, and medicinal herbs. Well, all modern nation-states claim a kind of rationalized origin story upon which they fashion patriotism or loyalty to the state. When citizens of modern states and their anthropologists and historians look at what they consider, quote, primitive societies, they identify their origin myths, quaint and endearing stories, but fantastic ones not grounded in reality. Yet many U.S. scholars seem unable or unwilling to subject their own nation-state's founding story to the same objective examination. The United States is not unique among nations in forging an origin myth, but most of its citizens believe it to be exceptional among nation-states, and this exceptionalist ideology has been used to justify appropriation of the continent and then domination of the rest of the world. Is one of the few states founded on the covenant of the Hebrew Torah or the Christian borrowing of it in the Old Testament of the Bible. Other covenant states are Israel and the now defunct apartheid state of South Africa, both of which were founded in 1948. Although the origin stories of these three covenant states were based on Judeo-Christian scripture, they were not founded as theocracies. According to the myths, the faithful citizens come together of their own free will and pledge to each other and to their God to form and support a godly society, and their God in turn vouchsafes them prosperity in a promised land or manifest destiny. The influence of the scriptures was pervasive among many of the Western social and political thinkers whose ideas the founders of the first British colonies in North America drew upon. Historian Donald Harmon Akinson points to the way that certain societies in certain eras of their development have looked to the scriptures for guidance and likens it to the way the human genetic code operates physiologically. That is, this great code has, in some degree, directly determined what people would believe and what they would do. Dan Jacobson, a citizen of Boer-ruled South Africa whose parents were immigrants, observes that, like the Israelites and their fellow Calvinists in New England, the Boers believed that they had been called by their God to wander through the wilderness, to meet and defeat the heathen, and to occupy a promised land on his behalf. A sense of their having been summoned by divine decree to perform an ineluctable historical duty. And this never has left the Boers and has contributed to both their strength and their weakness. Founders of the first North American colonies and later of the United States had a similar sense of providential opportunity to make history. Indeed, as Akinson reminds us, it is from the scriptures that Western society learned how to think historically. The key moment in history, according to covenant ideology, involves the winning of the land from alien and indeed evil forces. U.S. citizens did not inherit their cult-like adherence to their Constitution from the English. From the Pilgrims to the founders of the United States and continuing to the present, the cultural persistence of the covenant idea and thus the bedrock of U.S. patriotism represents a deviation from the main course in the development of national identities. Arguably, both the 1948 birth of the State of Israel and advent of the Nationalist Party rule of South Africa in 1948 were emulations of the U.S. founding. Certainly many U.S. Americans closely identify with the State of Israel as they did with Afrikaner-ruled South Africa. Patriotic U.S. politicians and citizens take pride in exceptionalism. Historians and legal theorists characterize U.S. statecraft and empire as those of a nation of laws, rather than one dominated by a particular class or group of interests, suggesting a kind of holiness. Parallel to the idea of the U.S. Constitution as covenant, politicians, journalists, teachers, and even professional historians chant like a mantra that the United States is a nation of immigrants. These were the settlers who fought their way over the Appalachians into the fertile Ohio Valley region, and it is they who claimed blood sacrifice for their country. Immigrants, to be accepted, must prove their fidelity to the covenant and what it stands for. These, then, were the settlers upon which the national myths are based, the ultimately dispensable cannon fodder for the taking of the land and the continent, the foot soldiers of empire, the yeoman farmers romanticized by Thomas Jefferson. The next chapter is called Bloody Footprints, and it's about basically how the U.S. Army was formed in the wars against the Native people east of the Mississippi. This is a quote from a military historian, John Grenier, in a book called The First Way of War. For the first 200 years of our military heritage, then, Americans depended on arts of war that contemporary professional soldiers supposedly abhorred, razing and destroying enemy villages and fields, killing enemy women and children, raiding settlements for captives, intimidating and brutalizing enemy non-combatants, and assassinating enemy leaders. In the frontier wars between 1607 and 1814, Americans forged two elements, unlimited war and irregular war, into their first way of war, which is still their way of war. So, I make throughout the book connections between the U.S. military today and its foundation in these unrelenting wars that actually went up through 1890 and then moved overseas to the Philippines and the Caribbean with the same generals in the Philippines who had been fighting the Sioux and the Cheyenne in the Northern Plains. And interestingly enough, also, who were called in, one division of them, to fight striking workers in Chicago. So I think there's very interesting interconnections with the use of the military in the United States that we don't always put together. You know, the Second Amendment and the irregular warfare, these were mostly settler militias who could organize themselves. Andrew Jackson started that way as the head of the Tennessee militia. His war, his militia's war against the Muscogee Creeks, driving them out of Georgia, he was made a major general in the U.S. Army. So it was a career builder as well to start a militia. But these were also used, especially after U.S. independence, as slave patrols, these militias, self-appointed militias. These militias would form to police free, you know, they weren't paid to do it. And we still see the ghosts of this performing actually today.
You're listening to Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, author of the 2014 Beacon Press book, An Indigenous People's History of the United States. I recorded her at Green Apple, one of the last used bookstores in San Francisco. Howard Zinn convinced Beacon Press to publish a series of forgotten and suppressed histories under the title Revisioning American History. Two issues have already been covered, disability and the queer history of the U.S. He requested that Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz be asked to write the Indigenous Peoples edition. In the Q&A session, she was asked to speak about the origin of AIM, the American Indian Movement.
The American Indian Movement, which started in 1968 and still exists, not as powerfully as it once did, it was a pan-Indian movement. People who started it were Anishinaabe and Lakota, and very strongly identified with their heritage, their languages, and so forth. But they reached out to everyone. They saw as their model Tecumseh, right after the independence, to 1808. They fought to keep people out of the Ohio Valley. And they famously, he and his brother, who was a medicine man, traveled all over and brought people together, different peoples from very different backgrounds, including organizing down in the South so that after he was killed, after they were killed, the brothers, the Seminole Wars took over. And the Seminoles were, of course, mixed African, escaped Africans and Muscogee Creeks. Their language was Creek, was Muscogee. And that was Jackson then trying to force them to give up the Africans among them, and with a promise they could keep this, keep that territory in the Everglades. But they wouldn't. They said, how can we do that? They had intermarried, they had children, we'd be giving you our own flesh. The American Indian Movement knew, you know, there were people who knew, who had been in prison. Two of the founders, the Anishinaabe, Clyde Billicourt and Dennis Banks, were in Stillwater Prison in Minnesota. So they wanted to Indianize everyone on the continent. This was their goal. And interestingly enough, the same thing was taking place in South America with the South American Indian Council in Bolivia. Their goal was to rescue the Indian and the mestizo. So this was, really a powerful movement in the 1960s of gift giving, of land as sacred, not property. and to recruit people of all kinds. Chicanos were involved from the very beginning. Chicanos were very organized then. They were organized into the Brown Berets, for instance. So there were alliances with the Brown Berets, with the Young Lords, with the Black Panther Party, and these rainbow alliances before Jesse Jackson took that name. They called themselves Rainbow. So there was a lot of interchange, and then right after Wounded Knee, they formed the International Indian Treaty Council, which included also the Pacific, the Maori of New Zealand, the Australian Aborigines, anyone who self-identifies as indigenous. So yeah, there's a lot of solidarity, and there's a lot of intermarriage, and there's a great desire on the part of almost every Native American I know to learn Spanish, to be able to communicate with some of the people coming in now. I think someone told me when I was in Los Angeles recently that there are probably about 100,000 indigenous Oaxacans in Southern California now. Keeps the right wing awake at night. I just love thinking of Pat Buchanan having nightmares about all these Indians taking over North America. I don't know if you've read Leslie Silko's Almanac of the Dead. You know, Leslie Marmon Silko, she's a poet and a writer. And Almanac of the Dead, she published it in 1992, you know, the quincentenary year. And she laid out a scenario in Chiapas that literally came true 2 years later. It is really remarkable to read that. And then the day I heard about the Zapatistas rising up, the Tetzal Mayans in Chiapas, New Year's Day, 1994, I thought, my God, this sounds like Leslie's story, you know, that she was telling. So it's pretty interesting. But she lives in Tucson, out in the country. She has a ranch with horses and stuff. There's a freight train that goes by coming up from Mexico. And, of course, the top is just filled with people. And she wrote an essay, well, this was like 20 years ago, in The Nation magazine, saying this is what keeps her alive every day, is looking and seeing at all those young Indians up on that freight train coming in to replenish the lost population in North America.
That was a quote from an essay by Leslie Marmon Silko, Laguna Pueblo author, in the Native American Renaissance. Among her novels are Ceremony and Gardens in the Dunes. The last question came from me. Did you write about the gold rush in California?
I'll read you a passage so you get a sense of it. This is the chapter called Sea to Shining Sea. United States taking half of Mexico and then getting to California. They hadn't yet conquered the interior, but they got sea to shining sea. Under the protection of the U.S. Army, beginning in 1848, gold seekers from all over the world brought death, torture, rape, starvation, and disease to the indigenous peoples whose ancestral territories included the sought-after gold fields north and east of San Francisco, peoples who had never been colonized by the Spanish. As Alejandro Murguia, our poet laureate of San Francisco, by the way, describes it in a wonderful book called Medicine of Memory. Unlike the native peoples for whom gold was irrelevant, the 49ers hungered for gold with a sickness. So I'll read you a passage from his book. They would do anything for it. They left families, homes, everything behind. They sailed for 8 months aboard leaky, smelly ships to reach California. Others, captains and sailors, jumped ship at San Francisco, leaving a fleet of abandoned brigs, barks, and schooners to rot by the piers. They slaughtered all the game they could find and so muddied the rivers and creeks with silt that the once plentiful salmon couldn't survive. The herds of elk and deer, the food source for Native Americans, were practically wiped out in one summer. The miners cheated and killed each other in the gold fields. So in a true reign of terror, the U.S. occupation and settlement exterminated more than 100,000 California Native people in 25 years, reducing the population to 30,000 by 1870. Quite possibly the most extreme demographic disaster of all time. Here too, against impossible odds, the indigenous peoples resisted and survived to tell the story. Had they not done so, there would be no indigenous peoples remaining in Northern California, because the objective was to eradicate them. From the onset of the California Gold Rush, crazed gold bugs invaded indigenous territories, terrorizing and brutally killing those who were in their path. These settlers seemed to require no military assistance in running roughshod over unarmed indigenous residents. The role left for the U.S. Army was to round up the starving indigenous refugees to transport them to established reservations in Oregon and Oklahoma. Yeah, some of them were actually sent to Oklahoma. So thanks for that question. Yes, you live up in the...
That was the first part of a one-hour program with Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, author, activist, and historian. Her most recent book, An Indigenous People's History of the United States, was published by Beacon Press in the fall of 2014. Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz grew up in rural Oklahoma, the daughter of a part Indian mother and a tenant farmer. After receiving her PhD in history at the University of California at Los Angeles, she taught in the newly established Native American Studies program at Cal State Hayward, and she helped found the departments of Ethnic and Women's Studies there. Dunbar Ortiz is the author or editor of seven other books, including Roots of Resistance, A History of Land Tenure in New Mexico, The Great Sioux Nation, Red Dirt, Growing Up Oki, and Blood on the Border, Memoir of the Contra War. She lives in San Francisco. Come back for more Q&A, including a discussion about the Great Sioux Nation, when TUC Radio returns. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. If you're unable to download online, you can get an audio CD at cost on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gilardin. Thank you for listening.